All right, it is time for us to get started. It is past time for us to get started. Yeah. Well, among those who are not with us today are all of our technical people that know what they're doing up here. So that drastically slows things down. And they're not seeing the right thing on Zoom right now. We'll try to fix that for them at 3 o'clock. So we're in the book of Daniel in our class. Let me just take a moment and express my gratitude to Greg and Dan for covering this last week. It's a rare thing for a group our size to have two preachers at the same congregation, much less to have two preachers and two people who used to be preachers who could step in at any moment. And the odds that all four of us are gone at the same time, I'm not sure how it happened, but it did, two assemblies in a row. So thank you guys for stepping up and filling in and making sure there was something going on here this past week. We are back in the book of Daniel, though, after a week off. We left off with Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the fright that was to him and the interpretation that Daniel brought to it. And we're moving on to probably one of the two most famous, familiar scenes in the book of Daniel, the fiery furnace here, the other one, of course, being the lion's den. So that's what we'll be talking about here in our class today. Let's begin, though, with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you that you are a God not only who reveals things because you know things, but who delivers us and who can be counted on to deliver us, even if not in the here and now, but eternally to be with you. We're thankful that you are a God who can find us in our distress, wherever that may be, and who joins us in our distress and will keep us through it. Be with us as we study today, that our minds and hearts would be open to your word. Help us to grow in our knowledge of you and to grow in our faith and our confidence in you. In your Son we pray, and amen. All right, Daniel chapter 3, the scene with the fiery furnace. Of course, it begins with, you know, Nebuchadnezzar calling all these people together, and we'll talk some more details here in a moment, calling all these people together on this plain and setting up this statue and telling everyone to bow down to it, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won't, and that leads them to being thrown in the fiery furnace. A question that I don't know if you've ever thought to ask this question or not, or if you have thought to ask it and you have a pretty good idea of what's going on in your own mind, but the question is, why does Nebuchadnezzar do this? What is the possible context? What is the possible reason? Why would Nebuchadnezzar say, you know what I think I should do today? I should set up a giant statue and make a bunch of people bow down to it, and whoever doesn't, I'll chuck them in the fire. You know, is that just Wild King's prerogative, that if he wants to do that one day, he can? Or is there something more rational going on here? And of course, we're not told in the text what exactly is going on, but there are two really good possibilities for a context of this, one drawn from the biblical context in chapter 2 itself, leading into chapter 3, and one drawn from a historical context that might fit this as well. So let me just quickly give you those two options. It's not a huge deal one way or the other, but I think it's helpful to think about what may be going on in Nebuchadnezzar's mind that would lead to this. So first of all, drawing out of chapter 2, Daniel has just interpreted this dream of a giant statue that's going to collapse due to its feet of clay and the disunity that there is there in that final kingdom. And so Nebuchadnezzar takes the same basic idea. He has a statue, but instead of being a head of gold and a chest of silver and so forth and so on, he makes the whole thing gold. Now, gold there is almost certainly gold overlay, not solid gold. It's wood or stone that has gold on top of it. That's how they built things in the ancient world. And it's a whole lot cheaper. That's probably what this was, for what it's worth. But the whole statue is gold now instead of just the head. It's a way of kind of symbolically extending his kingdom for the whole thing. And what does he want to do but get rid of the disunity? If he can get everyone to bow to his statue, there's unity and loyalty, and it's a way of, in his own mind at least, trying to undo Daniel's interpretation. He accepted Daniel's interpretation for what it was. He praised the God of Daniel for what the God of Daniel was able to do in revealing this information. And now he's setting about trying to change things. And that is absolutely the sort of thing that a king of Nebuchadnezzar's power and ego would do. So that may be something like that. Why is he doing this? Well, he wants to undo Daniel's dream. He wants to bring in unity and loyalty and all of these kinds of things and see if he can make his kingdom last longer and avoid, you know, there are no feet of clay in my empire. It's going to keep lasting or something along those lines. And so this would be very early in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Chapter 2 is the second year of the reign. This would be pretty quick on the heels of that would happen. The other possibility is about 10 years into Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Historically, there are several rebellions in 595 to 594 that Nebuchadnezzar has to put down one after another. For whatever reason, the people decided now's a good time to try to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, and he just had a year and a half or so of dealing with a lot of rebellions. And so he has gone around and put them down. And he has all of his, you know, regional leaders in various places that are very often, you know, natives of that land. Remember, he gets rid of one king of Judah and replaces him with another king of Judah who's in the same family. Zedekiah is one of the sons of Josiah who is reigning in Judah, but as a puppet ruler who's supposed to be loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are people of high influence in the provinces. And so what is he doing? He's taking all of these different people and bringing them all in and saying, let's see who you're loyal to. I've just been dealing with a bunch of rebellions, so now profess your loyalty to me. And that would fit very well in this context as well. He's been dealing with rebellions. He wants to promote loyalty. And one way or the other, whether it's one of those possible contexts or something completely different, what is key to this chapter from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective is, are the people loyal to me? It has less to do with whatever the statue might be and more to do with them bowing to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. Even if it's not a statue of him, it's his statue that he put up. And so, are you loyal to me or not, is the question here that is being raised. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what they would say is, no, we're not disloyal to you. We are loyal to you as far as we can be loyal to you, but there is a line that we will not cross. And when loyalty to you is in conflict with loyalty to our God, we will remain loyal to our God. So they look disloyal perhaps from one perspective, but they're not. It's just that he is demanding something of them that they will not do. So as we get into the text, and as usual, we won't take the time to read it. It's very familiar to you. Maybe this remote will work eventually. Yeah, there we go. So, what is this image that is raised up? Well, probably it's a image of a god. It's probably an idol rather than an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Because notice, as it continues on in verse 12, to jump ahead a little bit, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So there's at least some connection there with the gods and the golden image there. And Nebuchadnezzar will repeat that in verse 14. Is it true that you don't serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? And then they will then affirm the same thing in verse 18. We will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So there seems to be a connection between gods and this image. And so that's one thing that would make me think this. Another thing is that in Babylon, kings were not deified. This is something that varied from one ancient world to another, one ancient context to another. Some places, kings were deified. Sometimes they were deified in their life. Sometimes they were deified after they died. But in Babylon, kings weren't deified. So if he's expecting them to worship him, that is very much out of line with how Babylon did things. And then on top of that, if Nebuchadnezzar wanted them to worship him, why is he setting up a statue of himself instead of just standing there saying, hey, worship me, I'm right here? And so you put all that together, and probably this is a god rather than an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself. The best two guesses, and it's not that big of a deal, but Marduk is the chief deity of the Babylonian pantheon. So that's one good possibility. The other is the god Nabu, from which Nebuchadnezzar gets his name, and so that would be his patron deity. So one of those two is our best guess as to who the god they're being told to worship is. Again, not that big of a deal, but it's an interesting thing to kind of think through. Now, on the other hand, there would probably be a perceived equivalence between Nebuchadnezzar and his god. To support Nebuchadnezzar's god is to support Nebuchadnezzar. To reject Nebuchadnezzar's God is to reject Nebuchadnezzar. And so, even if it's not an image of Nebuchadnezzar, this is a question of loyalty and submission to this king, by loyalty and submission to this king's God. It is a very strange size. This is one of those things, I don't know if you've picked this up before in reading this, how odd the size of this would be. 60 cubits in its height and 6 cubits in its breadth. To put that in more familiar terms, it's about 90 by 9 in feet. Now, you think about an image that's 90 feet tall. How big of a base do you need for that thing to be stable? Well, I don't know what the exact answer to that is in terms of engineering, but I know it's bigger than 9 feet across. You need something a lot wider than that. And so people have suggested that there may have been a big platform at the bottom for stability. The word Dura, the plain of Dura there that it's set up in, it's a word that refers to walls. And so either it's a walled city or a city with a big wall there. And so some have suggested it may have been like even attached to or leaned up against the wall in some way for stability. We just don't know all of that. But it's a very top-heavy image, which it kind of is its own irony, right? If Nebuchadnezzar is trying to undo the image of this dream, of this statue collapsing, to build something that is so unstable as this, there's something kind of amusing about that as far as it goes. But what he does, again, whatever the exact nature of the statue may have been, he calls together, in verse 2, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So basically, anybody who was anybody was there at this scene. Now, this scene is a scene of a group of people that the text says is of the provinces. And that answers a question that pretty regularly gets asked in regard to Daniel chapter 3, which is, where is Daniel? And I've heard different people try to explain that in different ways. Well, maybe the king had sent him off on some business somewhere. And that's why I heard one person say, well, maybe Daniel was bowing down to the statue. And these are, no, I'm pretty sure that's not what was happening, whatever it was. I think the answer, though, is in that phrase that you just kind of read past quickly without even stopping on it. These are the governors and prefects and counselors and magistrates and so forth of the provinces. Daniel is in Babylon. He is in the palace. He's not in the provinces. And if this is that second historical scenario where there's just been all these rebellions out there and he's testing the loyalty of the people out there, he's not going to be testing the loyalty the same way of the people that are in his own household, so to speak. And so Daniel and the people that are there in Babylon are probably exempt from this. If it is specifically the people of the provinces who were called together. And they're told to bow down to this statue. And this then becomes both a first commandment issue and a second commandment issue, if you want to think in those kinds of terms. Have no other God before me and set up no graven image. Well, this is both of them all wrapped into one, which is why they're going to refuse to do this. And it's a very high-pressure situation when you stop and you think about it. First of all, there is the authority of the king that is behind this. He's saying, you must do this. And let's not forget, this is the most powerful human being on the planet at this point in history. There's nobody that has the power of Nebuchadnezzar, and it's not an easy thing to tell a man like this no. People like this would have your head cut off if you can't tell him what his dream is, as we saw in chapter 2. You know, you're going to get executed because you can't do the impossible. Here's something that's very possible. And so they know their life is at stake before this very powerful man. In fact, in the first 7 verses, Nebuchadnezzar is not just Nebuchadnezzar. He's going to become Nebuchadnezzar did this, Nebuchadnezzar did that, as the story goes on. But in the first 6 verses, or the first 7 verses, 6 times he is King Nebuchadnezzar. The narrator doesn't have to call him King Nebuchadnezzar every single time. He doesn't call him that every single time he's mentioned throughout the book of Daniel. But one way of emphasizing his authority when he makes this command is to call him King Nebuchadnezzar every time you talk about him. He is the king. You must do what he says. On top of that, of course, there is the pressure of conformity with the crowd. This is a massive, massive crowd of their peers, their superiors, and probably some of their underlings as well. They're all gathered together in verses 2 and 3. They're told what to do in verses 4 and 5. And they're threatened with a consequence in verse 6. And then notice in verse 7, therefore, as soon as all of these instruments played, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Imagine you're standing there on this plain, and you're surrounded by 1,000 people, and the king says, you must do this as soon as you hear these instruments play. And the instruments play, and 9,997 people all fall down. I just got to 10,000, didn't I? They all fall down at the same time, and the three of you are left standing there. I mean, this is beyond, you know, middle school peer pressure at this point. There is a load of pressure that comes with conforming to this crowd. And people look around and they're like, what are these guys doing? They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're not doing what we're doing. And so then they take this information to the king. And notice how the accusation is described in verse 8. Certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. It wasn't a curious question that they're being asked. It's a malicious accusation. There is anger and hatred in the voices of these people. And we don't know exactly why that is. It may be envy, like we see in chapter 6, where you've got, in some ways, a similar story with Daniel in the lion's den, where it's people that are angry about Daniel getting a promotion that is motivating them to be as evil as they are. That may be what's going on here. I mean, this doesn't seem to be a case where, like in Daniel 6, they conspired to have this scene so that they could catch them. That's not what's going on here. But they certainly pounce on the opportunity as quickly as they can. That they're called Chaldeans here. We talked about this in chapter 2. Chaldeans means one of two things in the book of Daniel. Either it refers to the ethnic group, people who are Chaldean ethnically, or it refers to a special class of people, that is magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, that group of people who are called Chaldeans as well. And either one of those would work in this case. It might be that it's the magician's class and their peers were promoted and they haven't been, and so they're upset about that. Or it might be the ethnic group, and here we are loyal to the empire, and look at those Jews over there. And that's kind of like, you know, Haman's accusation, right, in Esther 3. These people, they're not like us. They're different from us. And it's that outsider sort of accusation that was going on. And then on top of that, then finally, there is the intimidation of the penalty, that there is a fiery furnace that has been set up. So, you know, if the most powerful man on the planet telling you to do something and all the people around you doing that very thing isn't enough to make you want to do it, being tossed into a giant fire and burnt to death if you don't certainly brings some motivation as well and makes it a little bit harder to say no. Now, Babylonians were not people who typically would burn to execute. It does happen on a few occasions in the historical records, but this is not what they normally do to execute people. So they probably don't have a lot of, you know, people burning furnaces around. And so the typical suggestion for this is that this was a large kiln for some of the, you know, the architectural stuff they do. They would build giant blocks of clay and fire them to work. You've got to have a really big kiln for that. So if you imagine a dome shape, kind of think of like an igloo with a big smokestack coming out of the top of it, where you could see into the front, but also have access to drop them in from up top. That's probably something like that is what's going on here. So that kind of furnace for firing clay or smelting metal or something like that is what they were using as their means of motivation and then punishment to punish anyone who didn't do it. And there, you've got to be thinking that Nebuchadnezzar is certain that I won't have to use this thing. And he's thinking that for a couple of reasons. One, because I said to do it, so they're going to do it. And if that's not enough, I've got this terrible threat hanging over them, so surely they're going to do it. And then also the polytheistic mindset, we'll talk about this a little bit more in just a second, where they don't have any problem with bowing to another god and being faithful to your own god as well. That's just kind of how that mindset worked. It was very different from what we're accustomed to. You know, growing up as monotheists and reading a book, studying a book about our God that teaches monotheism, the polytheistic mindset is just so different from that. It's kind of hard. It's hard for us to comprehend how they get to the place they are at, but it's equally hard for someone who is steeped in that to comprehend monotheism. So I'll come back to that in just a second. Kayvon, were you going to say something a second ago? Oh. Wave at me if I don't see it.
They want favor from the king, and by being mad about, hey, they're not doing what you said, you know, they can curry favor.
Yeah, yeah, and that, I think that is at least potentially a part of it, is that it's not just putting down someone who's ahead of you, but it's also a way of building yourself up in the estimation of the king. It's kind of a two-for-one at that point. Yeah, and in the first few centuries, Christians were called atheists by the pagans around them, which just blows our mind. How can you call them an atheist when they worship a god? But it was because they deny the pantheon. They didn't worship the gods. And if you reject all of the Greek and Greco-Roman gods, then you've rejected the gods. And so it's, again, it's so backwards from how we think as monotheists, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around. But again, I think it's helpful to think it would be equally as hard for them to grasp this concept. And so what this leads to then is the rage of Nebuchadnezzar over their refusal to bow. This is what's upsetting him. How dare you not do this thing? And it's going to lead then to Nebuchadnezzar giving them a second chance to do this, here's your chance to fix you. It, clearly, it was your mistake in not bowing, not my mistake in promoting you to this position, is maybe part of what's going on here. So have another chance, and they're going to refuse, which is going to only make him madder. So as I was saying, this is something that would have been incomprehensible to Nebuchadnezzar, both because of that polytheistic mindset, where what the polytheist would say is, I will worship any god. As many gods as you can show me are worth worshiping, I will add that god to my shelf, and I will worship whatever god that there is. They don't very easily suddenly say, oh, this god is a real powerful god, therefore the other ones must be fraudulent. And you see that in the language of Nebuchadnezzar. We mentioned this last week, right? Where Nebuchadnezzar, what he says in Daniel 2 is, your god is a great god of revealing things. And here he's going to say, your God is a great God of delivering people. And so once you stop and think, okay, there's a God of the storm and a God of the sea and a God of death and a God of fertility and a God of the sun and a God of the moon, and now we have a God of deliverance and a God of revelation, that's kind of how he's thinking, is I'm adding a new God, or I'm seeing new traits of a new God, and oh, he does this and oh, he does this. He's clearly not converting, at least at the outset, to monotheistic worship of the God of Israel. That's going to become a question in chapter 4, where he gets much farther along than he does in chapters 2 or 3. But he just keeps, he's perfectly happy to keep adding gods to his shelf. And if that is your mindset, that any god who is a god can be worshipped, to look at these people who refuse to worship some god, that just doesn't register with him at all. And then on top of that, why on earth do you think your God can save? Notice what he says in verse 15, in particular here in Daniel 3. If I can turn one page instead of two. Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of, I'll skip all the instruments, fall down and worship the image that I've made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And you read the Bible and you think, oh, how dare someone say something like that? But you put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's shoes, who has conquered the known world, who has defeated every army that has come up against him, which means he's defeated every god that has come up against him, including Israel or Judah at this point, and destroyed the temple of Judah and plundered the temple of Judah, all of which says, I and my God are more powerful than you and your God. So who do you think you are that you can say no to me and you think your God's going to deliver you out of my hands? And there's, in addition to that, we saw in chapter 2, you know, the magician said to Nebuchadnezzar, only the gods can do this and their dwelling is not with man. It was almost borderlining on, you know, deism. There's a God, but he doesn't do anything, sort of mentality. So who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands? So it's incomprehensible to Nebuchadnezzar, both because of his polytheistic mindset, and also because of his perspective on gods and what they do and what they don't do and who he has shown himself to be. Go ahead, Andrew.
I also have to think it'd be a little insane to some extent. Because it changes a little bit as to what you said earlier, whether this is like pretty soon after or if this is those 10 years or so. But these three men that aren't bowing down are literally in the position that they're in because Daniel asked if they could be. Like, yeah. He didn't just promote them because he liked them necessarily. These three men were shown an extreme gift for the service of someone else. Mm-hmm. And these are the three men. They're gonna say no. Like, they haven't even done anything for me. And
right.
And then there's also the added, like, what is he thinking about Daniel now? Like, these are the men you had me promote. But
yeah. So I've got something along those lines here. This bottom point. It's an unexpected reaction of people that he promoted. You know, there is. Even if you're not happy, there can be a certain satisfaction in catching someone that you thought was up to something. You know, you set something up to get the person that you suspected of doing something wrong. You set it up, you catch them, and there may be sorrow depending on what it is, but there's satisfaction that you caught them. When you get blindsided by something and a disloyalty, and particularly if it's someone that you moved into a position, you honored them, and this is how they pay you back, that's going to make you even more upset. And I think there may be some of that as well here in how angry he is about all of this. Let me jump back up to the Deuteronomy passage here. You know, Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, your God couldn't possibly be more powerful than me and my gods. You think your God's going to save you. Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 39. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. And there is none that can deliver out of my hand, God says. And what is Nebuchadnezzar saying? There is no God who can deliver you out of my hand. He's basically quoting God and applying it to himself and saying, the God that you serve can't do the very thing that he said he could do, and I'm as powerful as he is. Now, he doesn't know that he's saying that because, you know, he's not been reading Deuteronomy. But there is kind of a certain, you know, irony and challenge of God's deity in what he says. Now, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that's my abbreviation there if you couldn't figure that out. They believe something unique in the ancient world. They and anyone who followed after the God of Israel, that is, believe something unique, that there was only one God who was the true God and who has absolute power exclusively. The God of the Bible is transcendent. He is entirely outside the universe and outside of creation. The gods of paganism were immanent. That is, they were part of the world. They were part of the universe. Now, of course, the God of the Bible becomes immanent as well in the New Testament, and the transcendence and immanence of God is one of the, you know, paradoxes and all of those kinds of things of the Bible. But in the Old Testament in particular, when God hadn't shown himself, he's shown himself to be near to his people, but he is still a very transcendent God as opposed to the gods of paganism. Now, verses 16 through 18, this is where they are kind of given the second chance. or they have been given the second chance, and this is their response. This is the pivot of the story, the center point of the story, where everything is going to turn on this scene. So, this chapter begins and ends with a decree of Nebuchadnezzar. The decree calling them together and telling them to bow, the decree concerning the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. There is the accusation that will lead to their death, which is the next point, and that's paralleled at the end with them being delivered from death. You have two sections that talk about the king's rage. The king's rage when they're first accused, and the king's rage when they don't obey the second time they're given an opportunity. And the center point that has no parallel is their obedience. This is the point of the story where everything begins to unwind narratively speaking. And, you know, as we've said, when there is this unparalleled line, however it's structured, when you have an unparalleled line, that's the kind of the key point of that narrative. And here, the key point is their obedience. They've been told to do something, they don't do it. They've been accused, and Nebuchadnezzar gives them a second chance to do it, which is to say, there's a second chance to sin. You know, this may be the devil's handiwork that, you know, whatever temptation they faced the first time, it must be even more now. As they're really put on the spot in front of everyone, and how easy it would be to rationalize. Before, you were like 50 rows back, now you're 10 feet away from this furnace going, man, that's pretty hot. You know what our nation needs, friends in high places. What good are we going to do for our people if we're dead? How quickly you could start to rationalize. Yet what they do is they obey. And their obedience and their confession is remarkable. The obedience just for the courage of it. But the confession, our God can indeed deliver. You know, He absolutely can do this. Verse 18, but if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so it's a response that says, our God can, we believe our God will, but if God doesn't, it doesn't matter, we're going to do the right thing anyway. And it focuses on God's will and God's pleasure, as those are called sometimes. God's ability and God's pleasure, I'm sorry. God's ability being what God can do, and they say God can do this. And God's pleasure being what God will do. What He decides to do is up to Him. And they leave that in His hands. And as they think about God's will, there are two things there to think about as well. There's God's revealed will, what God has said He wants, and there's God's circumstantial will, which is what God decides to do in any situation. And they know God's revealed will. Have no other God before me. Bow to no graven image. They don't know God's circumstantial will. Is God going to deliver us right here in this moment? And so what they do is they base their decision on what they know about God's will, not what they don't know about God's will. God said, don't do this, therefore we won't do this. And whatever God decides to do in the moment, we'll accept it because we're going to do what God has said to do and what we know is God's will. Greg, I saw your hand a second ago.
I just found it interesting that He even gave them a second chance.
Yeah.
The commentators think about that. Why? Other than the fact that at the very beginning, I mean, these were the top four people, the captives that came, and He had to have known who they were.
Yeah. I mean, it could be something. And I mean, people have said a variety of things. None of them has really stood out to me as being, oh, that must be the answer. The idea that comes, that strikes me as the most plausible, at least, is something along the lines of Nebuchadnezzar saying, oh, there must be some mistake here, and it must be the mistake you made, not the mistake I made. You know, here's your chance to prove to me that I didn't make a mistake by promoting you to this position. You made a mistake by not doing what you were supposed to do. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what his motivation was in a second chance.
I was gonna say, it's insulting to his regime, mm-hmm. his leadership, you know, go against him. So it's a chance for them to make up for that, him to look better.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So then, finally, as we come to the conclusion of this story, there is the account of them actually being thrown into the fiery furnace, and suddenly things not being what they're supposed to be. It's not what we anticipated. So as they are tossed in, first, you know, Nebuchadnezzar says, well, let's make sure these guys die. Crank up the heat seven times as hot as it was, and they're... you know, this probably, they're probably not measuring this precisely. All right, get the thermometer. They were probably not capable of producing a fire that was seven times as hot as a normal fire. This is a make it as hot as you can sort of figure of speech. But whatever the case is, it's hot enough that the people who throw them in get killed. Now stop on that for a second. Who are the people that get killed? The people who threw them in. Who bowed down to the statue? Everybody but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the people who secured their safety by bowing down died. The people who are going to be killed by not bowing down, they're going to be thrown in and they're going to live. Now you tell me whose God is stronger here? The God of the statue or the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? So their death is a very subtle jab at this other God and showing that he has no power at all. And that leads then to the surprise of Nebuchadnezzar as he's looking there going, okay, they're not dead. And who's that other guy in there? What exactly is going on that they're walking around? They've been bound and they've been thrown in, and apparently everything that had bound them has been burned away. Their clothes, however, haven't. And someone else is on the scene now as well. And so there's just this shock from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective. He says it looks like a son of the gods is in there with them. Now understand, it's a typical word for God, which is typically plural in the Old Testament, even when it's talking about the God of Israel, it's the plural word for God. But on Nebuchadnezzar's lips, gods almost certainly means gods in the plural. What he says when he says a son of the gods, he doesn't mean, hey, look, that's Jesus. That's not what Nebuchadnezzar's saying. What he's saying is a divine being of some kind. It looks like there's a divine being of some kind in there with them. Real quick, I'll come to you, Savannah. They pull them out of the fire, and there's the evidence that they have been delivered. Not a hair is singed. There's not even a smell of smoke on their clothing, which is going to lead to Nebuchadnezzar's confession about the God of Israel and his decree about the God of Israel. So blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his messenger and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. Seems like Nebuchadnezzar's go-to, I guess. Saw that one in chapter 2 as well. For there is no other God who's able to rescue in this way. So God, the God of deliverance, chapter 2, God, the God of revelation. But he still doesn't understand who God is yet because he's only seeing him in these small slices and thinking, oh, he's a God of deliverance. Oh, he's a God of revelation. But you know what? I better issue a decree that's going to protect him from slander. Yeah, God needs your help, Nebuchadnezzar. We just saw this in chapter 3, that God needs your help to protect him. No, he still doesn't understand God yet. And the fact that he's about to be he's going to deify himself, basically, in chapter 4, further indicates he doesn't understand God yet. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be promoted as this chapter comes to its conclusion. Savannah.
More like details, but you mentioned
Well, that's kind of a guess, but yeah. I think that's what the text says, right?
They fell into it.
Verse 23, they fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Now, I guess you could push them and they fall in as well. And that's just kind of typically, kind of reconstructing from what we know about that part of history and what they had available is that kind of big kiln that would have a smokestack at the top and you build something up to it, you can toss them in from above rather than having to get... It would be safer up there than right at the opening for someone to put them in as well, less heat coming out. So, but again, we don't know exactly what it was. The text isn't detailed there.
And then you said this
looks
like the son of the gods.
Yeah.
Like demigods or the gods
who created humans. Is that what maybe. I mean, he's not especially clear as to what he means by that. I think at the very least... divine being or semi-divine being or something. He will say, he sent his messenger or angel, your translation might say, someone from God first or second came to help them, someone who appears like a god or a child of the gods or something like that. So, yeah. David?
In verse 21, they mention that the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are wearing robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, and then they're thrown in. And it mentions later that their robes were not scorched, but it doesn't mention the other stuff.
Is there
some of their clothes burned?
I presume the second instance it's a kind of metonymy thing where you mention the one to signify all of the others, but I just an interpretive guess. I don't know if you can prove that one way or the other.
This is not too big a question, just for the last
time. All right, Greg. No, go ahead, go ahead.
I could, obviously I'm not polytheistic, but I could fairly easily understand to some degree why, you know, this would be a big hang up for them. Because one of the things that's always like just made me slightly nervous or just unable to answer was you know, how the magicians or whatever they are in when it comes to that interaction with Moses, how they were able to replicate these things. And it's like, okay, well, you know, God just like giving them a moment to shine or whatever. But like I think about, you know, the times in which, you know, these gods are able to like do something that, you know, normal person would be able to do, or like you hear about like divination or whatever. These occurrences did happen. I could see how some people could believe, you know, these other entities had some kind of power and there wasn't just like one God.
Yeah. Was there a question there? No, there doesn't have to be. It can just be a comment. I just wanted to see if there was...
The question's for later.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't supposed to be answering something. So, yeah. I certainly could see that as well. I mean, if... And we don't know all the details. I mean, you know the Egyptian sorcerers threw down their staffs and they became serpents. And different people have handled that in different ways. But if you take at least the possibility that these gods were doing something because they have the power of demons behind them, as Paul even says really in the New Testament, right? Then that could be a very scary world to live in where it gives you a little bit more pause before you just reject one of the gods outright. Then you really have to have faith that your God is stronger than them as opposed to your God is stronger than nothing. I mean, if it's no God ever done anything, and our God has, then yeah, obviously our God's the best. But if other gods do some things, then that kind of changes the nature of the faith you need to have. Greg?
And having been in government employment, many times, and I'm sure it's this way in the civilian world too, there's a group of people who thrive on trying to do as little as possible and not being obedient to that.
Not just in the government.
As Christians, we're supposed to be doing that. I say this because somebody made the comment last week, who are you trying to impress, Greg? Referring to my boss. And I go, I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm just doing my job.
Right.
And I'm wondering if it was that way with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were doing God's will. That God put them there. They were thriving in the place they were. And they were watching out for Nebuchadnezzar's best interest. And every step of the way, these guys have been fully... you know, obedient to what Nebuchadnezzar wanted and trying to carry out his will. And here all of a sudden, like you said, he's shocked almost that these three guys would not do, because in his mindset, it's just one more God. Just bow down to him like you do all the other ones.
Yeah.
And so I can see him really being shocked, but still wondering, like you said, they must not have understood.
Yep. All right, well... we're out of time, but we're not waiting on any kids to come out, so I'm going to talk for a few minutes longer, as I have been doing in this class. I do want to think, as I've been trying to do, think in terms of some kind of practical application of the chapter, having looked at it kind of all at once rather than kind of piecemealing it out. There are a couple things in particular that really stand out to me about this chapter. One is there is a mockery of idolatry that happens in this chapter that's a bit more subtle than we might realize, although once you see it, it's one of those, how did I miss that, once you see it. So, in verses 1 and 15, which is kind of, you know, bracketing this opening section in some sense, verses 1 and 15, this image is described as a god that the king made, which is theologically asinine, to worship something that was created, instead of worshiping something that creates you. Now, more than that, in verses 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 12, 14, and 18, it's a god that the king stood up. The god made the king stand. Why is this giant god standing there? Well, because the king made it stand. The king made it, and the king stood it up. Only because of that. In contrast to, you know, what Daniel has said about God, the God of Israel, in verse 21 of chapter 2, he changes times and seasons, he removes kings, and he sets up kings. The God of Israel sets up kings. This is a statue that a king set up. And it's a statue that the king made as opposed to the king that God made. And so there is this kind of mockery of idolatry that's happening. And yeah, it's still a terrifying trial for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I don't think we should underemphasize that. But at the same time, it's a pretty spectacular farce that's happening here. A god that's made, an image that's set up. The fear isn't taken away, but if you can see beyond the fear to the complete lack of truth that is there, and know where the truth is and know where to put your faith, if you can see the emptiness behind the facade of power, you're far less likely to be intimidated by the pressure. And that doesn't mean the pressure's gone. That doesn't mean it's not scary. But if you can see the emptiness behind the facade of power, it's not as scary as it was. And it makes being obedient even easier. But what matters here, to make a second point, what matters here is not whether they are delivered, but whether they are obedient. And they understand that. We make this story about their deliverance, and it is a story about their deliverance, there's no doubt about that, but it's even more a story about the obedience of faith. And it's a faith that knows the power of God, for they say He is able, but it's also a faith that guards the freedom of God, because they say if God doesn't, that's fine with us, but because they ultimately hold to the truth of God, which is we will not serve your gods. We will do what God has told us we must do in, you know, those most basic commandments of our faith. And as you look at this, you know, our goal is not to predict the ways of God, but hold to the word of God. Not to manipulate the hand of God, but to obey the truth of God. Not to plot the course of God, but to follow the command of God. And you see that in them, and how they handle all of this. I'm trying to decide if I wanted to do one or two more. Let me go to just one last one. And that is that as you think about this as a story of deliverance, which it is, like I said, to a lesser degree a story of deliverance than it is a story of obedience and faith, it's a token of the kind of deliverance that God can give, not a blueprint of the kind of deliverance that God will always give. We can't look at this kind of story and say, you know, God will always dramatically deliver us in every single case. No, that's not what the case is. And even as you look at what happens, remember that they are not kept from being thrown into the fire. They are thrown into the fire and God joins them in the fire. They're not delivered from the fire, they're delivered in the fire. Those are two very different things. They go through it and God goes through it with them. God never says that you will not have to walk down the valley of the shadow of death. David says, even when I do walk down the valley of the shadow of death, you will be with me. And that's the same thing that's happening here. They're not kept out of the fire. They're delivered in the fire. He doesn't always shield us from every danger or distress or betrayal, but He walks beside us in the midst of it. I really like the way one author put this. He said, He has the knack of both exposing you to, yet keeping you through waters and rivers and fire, citing a passage from Isaiah, and operating rooms and funeral parlors in an empty house. The fourth man can always find his people. If you think of this as a story of deliverance, think of it in the terms that what matters here is not His deliverance from trials, but His presence in trials. Not to spare us from difficulty, but to join us in the difficulties we face. Dan, and then we'll be done.
It was curious to me that all the civilizations, and almost universally, were polytheistic. But they came from, their history was monotheistic. And I think this is the story that explains that kings set up gods so that they can control the people, and that they don't have to listen to a higher power. They get to decide what their lives and others are going to do.
Yeah, that certainly is clearly the case here, and it's, I would say, it could probably be extrapolated much wider than this. That kind of motivation very well fits someone in that position of power. All right, I'm past time, and I'm past the time that I planned on stopping, so I need to stop talking at this point, and we'll pick up next week with chapter 4.